Good evening. My name is Marty, and I'm an alcoholic. Excuse my attire, but I didn't know until about 3 hours ago that I was going to be up here. So I didn't come here prepared to with a suit and tie. But anyway, my sobriety date is January 21st, 1991, and my home group is the Denver Thursday Night Group. It meets at 16th and Sherman at 9 o'clock on Thursday nights in Denver, and if you're in that area, please drop by. We'd love to have you. Everything I know about what I used to be like, I learned through doing the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because when I first got here, I thought that I was this great guy, that I had never done anything to hurt anybody. I hadn't hurt my family. I hadn't done anything to anybody else. And so I thought that I had it all going on. And what I found out was is that the truth was is that that wasn't the truth. The truth is that when I started drinking at 13, what happened was is that I had another drink. I mean, the first time I had a drink, I always had another drink. And that was the truth throughout all the time that I drank. And what happened was is that no matter how I tried to control that or do anything about that, I didn't have any success. And so I suffer from a disease that is that progresses. And so I started drinking at 13. By the time I was 18, my mother, not knowing what else to do, had called Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I came home from school, and there's somebody standing from, I had gotten drunk over the weekend. My mother and I'd had a discussion, and I came home from school, and my mother has this guy standing in the living room, and he tells me he's from Alcoholics Anonymous, and asks me if I want to, you know, if I have a problem with alcohol. And I said, no, you know, I don't have a problem with alcohol. I'm only 18, and and I drink like just like all the rest of my friends. And so he wished me well, gave me his card, and went on his way. And I drank for another 25 years. Not successfully, but I drank for another 25 years. So the thing about me is that you know I have all this fear, but it comes out as being obstinate. It comes out as being a lot of different things that it doesn't look like I'm in fear, but I want you to think that I'm better than you, that I've got all this stuff. And so God ended up, I drank for 25 years, but what ended up happening was is that he had to finally put me in a position where I needed to be helped. And so I ended up, I got really sick from the drinking because I was drinking around the clock. And I was a maintenance drinker, and I'd get up in the morning and I'd have a drink, and I'd take a drink to bed with me at night, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and have a drink. And that, you know, that'll cause problems with your esophagus after a while. And so I had this bleeding, I had a bleeding ulcer, and it ruptured, and I ended up going to the hospital. Not by choice, because when the people that I had offered to take me asked me if I wanted to go, I said no. You know, I'm going to be fine. And I'd already lost about 2.5 pints of blood, and so I was in pretty bad shape. And so they called the hospital to find out what was going on, and the people at the hospital told them, "Do you want us to send an ambulance, or are you going to bring him over?" So they took me to the hospital. The first thing that the doctor started talking to me about in the emergency room was, you know, it was my drinking. And he asked me, you know, how much I drank. And now at that point, I'm drinking about a quart of vodka a day, and I'm telling him that I'm having a couple of drinks. So, you know, I don't want to be honest with the doctor. How can he know how to help me if I'm not even willing to be honest with him? The next day, though, he had all the test results back. And so he comes into my room and he lays it all out in front of me and tells me, you know, if you continue to drink the way you're drinking, you're only gonna last about another 3 years. Your liver's pretty well shot. And so that got my attention. You know, he said, I know some people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know some people in a recovery center, and we can find you some help if you want it. And so I told him, yeah, that'd be great. I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my last drink, my sobriety date's 1991, but my last drink was in October 2nd of 1982, and I'll explain to you what happened. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the thing was is that I had a lifestyle that I wanted to keep. I was doing some illegal transactions, and I was making a lot of money doing these illegal transactions, and I knew that if I got a sponsor and if I talked to him about all the stuff I was doing, that he would probably tell me I needed to quit doing that, and that was something I didn't want to do. And so because of these illegal transactions that I was doing, I was selling wares that needed to be sampled, and so I was sampling the wares and telling people that I wasn't that I was sober, and in reality it was a lie. But I don't want you to know that about me. I don't want people in Alcoholics Anonymous to know that I'm dishonest. I don't want them to know that I'm in fear, that I'm selfish, that I have resentments and those kinds of things. So when I happened to make a phone call to a woman that I had known when I was in high school, and it was just a fluke. I happened to see a phone book and gave her a call. And left a message, and then I got antsy and called her back again, and she answered the phone, and we started talking, and I found out that she was 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm telling her that I'm 5 years sober, and she says, "Oh yeah, where are you going to meetings?" And I said, "I'm not," you know, and she says, "Well, I don't know how you do that, and stay sober," and I said, "Well, I just don't go." Best answer I had. So she offers me to sleep on her couch, and we're going to meet with some friends down here in Denver. I'm living up in Breckenridge, actually hiding out in Breckenridge because of all the other things that I'm doing. And so she invites me down, and it's strictly platonic. She starts talking. We stay up that night, and she starts talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and where she's going to meetings. And she starts asking me to listen to these tapes on my trips back and forth to Breckenridge. And one of those tapes was, well, more than one of the tapes was Don Pritz. And so I'm listening to these tapes going back and forth to Breckenridge, and all of a sudden I'm hearing this stuff. And I'm going like, wow, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. That's what I should be doing. That's what I need to do. In January of 1991, I walked into Denver Thursday night. But I'm bringing all this baggage with me. I'm telling people I'm still sober. And I walk in and I owe the IRS, 10 years worth of back taxes. And that was another reason that kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, was because I didn't want to get honest about that. I was afraid that I'd have to go get a job. And then they'd find out that I owed all these taxes, and the IRS would come and take my money, you know. And that was the deal. I was always trying to protect my money and my reputation and all this stuff. So what ended up happening is that she knew she called Don Pritz and asked him where he was going to meetings, and he said he was going to Denver Thursday night. And so I went there and asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he said, "Well, let me pray about it." And when he and then he said, "But you need to show up at this other meeting." And so I I ended up going to another meeting and showing up and talking to him, and he said yes, he'd sponsor me, but I needed to meet with him at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I went, whoa, you know, that's a lot to ask. And but that's just how Don did things. You know, I mean, he wanted to see, first of all, if you'd meet him at another meeting, because he wanted to see if you were, you know, reliable enough, you know, whether or not, you know, you would do that. Really gave him an idea whether or not you were going to show up in the mornings to do the work with him. And if you were willing to come all the way out to his house in Aurora from wherever you were, then that showed him that you were responsible and you really wanted to work the program. But anyway, he and I talked about my IRS problems and stuff, and he told me that there was a place on at the IRS, especially for alcoholics, that they understood what was going on with us. And I didn't believe him, but I did the work, you know. So I went home and I compiled 10 years worth of back taxes. I laid everything out on the floor, crawled around on my hands and knees, put things in piles, and finally I got everything together to be able to submit it to the IRS. And I took over a stack of papers to the to the post office on April 15th and turned it in, and then just waited. what ended up happening was that. The IRS finally contacted me 3.5 years later. And the thing was that there's all kinds of rules about this, that kind of stuff. So I was able to cut a deal with them. Actually, I owed them over $700,000 in back taxes and penalties and interest. You know, it mounts up after a while. And especially if you don't file and do all that kind of stuff. I'm able to cut a deal with the IRS, and they took a lot of that away, and so I was able to pay off the IRS. Don and I, at one point in time, after this conference, and this conference has been responsible for a lot of things that have happened to me in here. I asked him if I could. Changed my sobriety date because I was, you know, I had been dishonest, and he and I discussed that, and I did some inventory around it, and I was able to, I changed my sobriety date, apologized to my home group because I'd been lying to them for 5 years, and it changed my life. So I guess my time's up. I don't know how much more over because I wasn't watching Pam, but anyway, thank you very much for my sobriety, and.
Hi, good evening, everyone. My name is Mary Michelson, and I'm a really very grateful recovering member of the Al-Anon Family Groups. I got a lot of interesting feedback when people started finding out that I was going to be the 10-minute Al-Anon speaker. Some people were like, oh, that is so great. A couple people were like, oh, 10 minutes, that's tough. And my favorite one yesterday from my friend Chris B. said, don't screw it up and don't lie. So with that, I will do my best not to screw it up and not to lie. I really am grateful to be here. I moved away from Denver last November back to my hometown in my home state of Nebraska, and I lived here for 4 years. This is my fifth FOTS conference, and my cup runneth over tonight with gratitude for my friends, the fellowship. I feel like I'm drinking from the saucer and slurping from the table with the laughter and the love and the joy that I get from being around program people. You are my chosen family. And I heard a new word, or an acronym, I guess is the right, it would be a FOO, my family of origin. And I love them too, but you guys are way more fun. And I'm really, really, really thankful for your friendship. I was having lunch this week with a friend of mine who is not in a program, and I've known him for about 10 years, and he's never asked me a lot of questions. He knows I go to Al-Anon, and if you ask me, which he doesn't, I would say he could use a program. But he asked me what I was coming to Colorado for, and I told him I'd be sharing. And he does not believe alcoholism is a disease, and that I know. He has shared that with me. And he said, well, what are you going to talk about? And I said, I'm going to talk about my recovery. And he said, well, what exactly are you recovering from? You don't have a problem with alcohol. And I think that's a really great question. And I gave him kind of a high-level answer because I don't know really how interested he was. But I explained that I believe that alcoholism is a family disease. And having grown up in a home where someone's drinking really bothered me, I qualify for membership based on our traditions. But then I got to reflecting on that question a little more, especially in thinking about sharing with you all tonight. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a list about what I was like before the program. And I was looking at this list last night, and I thought, you know, this is what I'm recovering from. So I'm going to, if you'll bear with me, read through some of these things that I feel like I'm recovering from. And remember that I feel like I came here because of someone else's drinking. I was a rule follower. I use the word appropriate a lot. I'm a good girl, very good girl, because of that rule following thing. But I have a lot going on underneath the surface. And most of what was going on under the surface was anger. But good girls don't get angry. And I also thought that anger was a character defect. I didn't know that it was just a feeling. I was dishonest with myself and others, a blamer, a doormat, an approval sucker, if Malia is in here today, if anyone was at the third step panel, definitely an approval sucker. Everything I did, everything I said was because I wanted you to love me, approve of me, validate me in some way, because I didn't like myself. I didn't know myself. I didn't like myself. And I don't know. I sought everything, happiness, joy, approval, everything from outside of myself. I had a lot of expectations, and that led to a lot of disappointment. I was a chameleon. I was who I thought you wanted me to be. I was embarrassed easily, believing that my family and my friends, or my significant other, were a reflection on me. I felt I didn't have a voice or choices about the direction of my life because I just did what others wanted, or at the very least, what I thought they wanted me to do. My life was missing direction that only God could provide, but I didn't know that. Finally, I was just plain uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable in my skin. I was uncomfortable around you. I was uncomfortable alone, and I was uncomfortable being uncomfortable, and I didn't know how to deal with that. Now, having read that list, not any of those things had to do with anybody else in my family, or their drinking, or their not drinking. I came from a loving family. We were very functional, actually. My dad never missed a day of work due to his drinking, no matter what time he passed out the night before. He wasn't violent. There was always food on the table, clothes. I was spoiled, actually. I'm just going to say it. I was the baby, and I was spoiled. I liked it. I knew it. And there was no tragedy. There was no great tragedy in my life. I don't know where all this came from. I don't know that if you had plucked me out of that family and plopped me else, you know, in someone else's family, that I wouldn't have those same feelings and those same symptoms of this disease. But I kind of believe that I would. And Erica said this morning also on that third step panel, three words that described AA: it's not them. Well, those same three words describe how I feel about Al-Anon. It's not them. And it wasn't really until I came to my first FOTS conference that I got that something clicked in me. I'm not just suffering from the effects of someone else's drinking. I believe if that were the case, then when I moved out of my parents' house, I'd have been okay. I'd have been a different person, and these things wouldn't still be troublesome for me. I'm crazy whether they're drinking or not. And so I have the disease of alcoholism. I have it myself. And when I read the big book and I study the big book and I work the steps, you're talking to me, you know, and I read that and I feel indeed like I have alcoholic thinking. I have the spiritual brokenness. None of that is different for me. And so I feel like I really could go either way in either program. In fact, I have some friends that will tell you I'm a six-pack short. In fact, I've questioned myself over the years because I have tried alcohol as a way to soothe this spiritual sickness that I have. I've also tried cigarettes and shopping and food and relationships and you name it, I've tried it. My favorite is food. And so it is definitely a spiritual sickness that I suffer from. And it has been so different since I worked the steps through the Big Book, which just happened a couple of years ago, actually. I've been in Al-Anon since May 11th of 1990. And I worked the steps a couple of times with my sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for 22 of the 23 years that I've been here. And she's amazing. And she's so gentle with me. And her guidance is so strong. And she's so wise. And I don't know why we didn't talk about the Big Book very much. I didn't ask about it. She gave me one. She gave me one as soon as she started sponsoring me. And I looked at it, I highlighted a few things, and then I put it on a shelf. And again, it wasn't until I came to this conference and started talking about it and studying it that things really started to become different for me, and my program has changed in a way that I never thought possible. This past June 17th, one of the readings in Our Courage to Change has a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson at the bottom, and it says, "There is guidance for each of us, and by lowly listening, we shall hear the right word. Certainly, there is a right for you that needs no choice on your part. The right for me that needs no choice on my part is this. It's the 12 steps. It's Al-Anon, it's AA, and I know that there are people in my life and my family who don't get that, and that's okay. I get it, and I can't imagine my life without it. I also believe today that the unmanageability that we talk about in step one all has to do with choice, and I've been reminded over and over again this weekend about the choices that have been presented to me because I've worked the 12 steps, because I've had a spiritual awakening, because I have a personal relationship with a higher power today. And it's not perfect. I'm ever so grateful for the slogan, progress, not perfection. But I am continuing to put effort towards my spiritual growth, towards my mental health growth, towards my physical health and well-being. And I believe that God appreciates that effort. I love this program. I love all of you. And that's all I have to share. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Washougal, Washington. My sobriety date is November 17th, 2005, and my home group is the West Vancouver group that meets on Thursday nights in Vancouver, Washington. So I'm very grateful just to be the 10-minute speaker instead of having to do a longer time. Speaking of gratitude, actually, that's not one of my favorite topics of a meeting. I've experienced a lot of gratitude from my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, but how I got there was basically through like grudge lists. I don't mean it to be a downer. I'm going to start out that way, but then I'll go up. Because I want to talk about, failure, unmanageability, and surrender. First of all, I guess, what it was like, I saw Aaron this morning, and I just said, thank you for doing my qualifying for me. I was a blackout drinker, and I didn't know I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for 4 years dating him. I was that girl that he described, that he dated and then he got engaged to. So I was just a mess. And I never drank normal. I started drinking at a young age. And every time I drank, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I'd wake up the next day and I'd say, this isn't going to happen again. And it would start again. So I'm definitely in the right place. And so not only did I do that for 20 years, that showed my powerlessness, that once I had it in my body, I couldn't stop. And when I wasn't drinking, I was obsessing about it. Those are evidence that I'm an alcoholic, but also you know, my 4 DUIs, my 5 driving under revocations, and my 9 arrests kind of give me a permanent record that show that I qualify for this program. So one of my favorite things, too, you know, so this failure thing, I was talking to somebody last night about it, and not only did that was I a failure in life before Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had experience of failing in Alcoholics Anonymous. But also my experience with that is that when I'm facing that failure and I'm in that failure, that is a perfect time to cheerfully capitalize on trouble because it's an opportunity to experience God's omnipotence. And how I've been able to do that is through this step. So when I first got here, I was facing 3 years in prison because of my driving record and all the DUIs and driving under revocations. And I came into the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started working the steps. Not right away, but I kept hearing, do the steps, do the steps, do the steps. So I started doing the steps, and I wanted to talk about my problems, and I wanted to figure out how to solve my problems, but my sponsor just kept wanting me to go to meetings, work on my step work, be of service, and have a service position, even though I was doing community service. And all she would focus on is my program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like, I needed help in real life. And but somehow I had enough willingness to do the things that she suggested as I was trying to figure out my own life. And as I did these things that she suggested, my life started changing, and that was the first time that my life had ever changed. And I had tried I had a lot of resources growing up. I had an education, I had a job, I had family that loved me, and none of that helped, you know, and I had every self-help class imaginable, and I read every book, and nothing could help with my failure at life and my drinking and my ability to stop drinking. So while I was doing these steps, my life started changing, and instead of going to jail or prison for 3 years, I ended up going to jail for 12 days. And it was a direct result of doing these steps, not trying to manipulate myself out of the system. Because I knew I had surrendered to the fact that if I was supposed to, the steps took me along far enough that I knew that if I was going to go to prison for 3 years, that that's where God would want me to be, and somehow He would take care of me. And somehow in that surrender, that's when the miracles happen for me, when I surrender to what is. It was nice that I only had to go to jail for 12 days, and I really don't want to go back, but it was a decent experience. So I finished the steps, I get on my merry way, and I start thinking that I should start managing my life now that I'm sober, because now I'm smarter and stronger, and I got my problems behind me. But that's not the case. So my experience is that, you know, as I started trying to be a better person in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started making decisions based on self that later put me in a position to be hurt. And according to my sponsor, I came very close to taking a drink. I didn't feel that. I didn't know it at the time. And thank goodness some people rallied around me, and I was willing to do the steps again. So I wasn't thinking about drinking, but I was having problems in all the bedevilments. I was having problems in personal relationships, fear of economic insecurity. I wasn't able to, every relationship that I had, I was destroying and thinking that it was all their fault. So I did the steps again. And in doing the steps again, I got to another level of surrender and looking at beliefs that I had that were the flaws in my makeup that were causing my failures. And so in doing so, I guess that I got the experience where God can turn any failure into a success and heal anything in my past. So it was just the most amazing experience. I thought I was going to die, and I was willing. I got to enough pain in sobriety that I started doing the steps again, and I was able to surrender to the fact that this isn't working, this isn't working, this isn't working, and it was just getting worse and getting worse and getting worse. But I had no other options. I never experienced that jumping off point with alcohol, because even though I had 4 DUIs and 9 arrests, somehow I thought it was still working for me. I never thought I couldn't live without it. I knew I couldn't live without it, but I never thought I couldn't continue living with it. The judge is the one that thought I couldn't continue living with it. But with my character defects, I did get to that point. I got to that point in myself where I can't go on living the way I am in sobriety, the way I am, or I can't surrender either. I can't imagine what I would be like or what my life would be like if I surrendered 100% my character defects. But I got to that jumping off point, and so I did surrender, and that's when miracles started happening in my life. I was in the morning meditation meeting this morning, and I was talking about, basically, I was through that step work, I was also praying on my face, not even on my knees. I was willing to surrender that much. And while I was on my face, you know, my job situation turned around. A man that I had been engaged to, that I tormented 12 years previously, that I had made amends to the year before, came and started courting me, and we actually got married 2 years ago. We got married after 2 years, and I've been married 4.5 years now. Happily. And I've never been able to have it as, I was a failure at relationships, 100%. And so through the step work, I was able to have a relationship, and as of today, it's successful. So today is what matters, I think. Thank you. And I think he would clap too. So, and also, you know, I was a failure at work. I couldn't seem to make. Well, I could make a living, but I couldn't seem to do anything with my money that was right, or have money, even though I made a lot of money. So. Or enjoy my work, or be of service at my work. And especially my fear was going forward with working with a permanent record like mine, you know, that doesn't look too good on job applications, 9 arrests. I mean, it's usually, you know, if you have 1 arrest and try to explain that away, but 9 arrests. But my experience has been I've had situations where 1 arrest would keep you away from something, and I've had to explain the 9, and I've received what I needed, even though I had 9 arrests, and that was impossible. So I guess my story is that, you know, my experience is when I'm willing to surrender everything to God, God 100% can heal my past, can help me with my permanent record, and being a failure on my own is okay now, because now I have a power greater than myself that can if I rely on that power, remarkable things happen in my life. And I just have to continue to do this work to get out of the way, to remind myself that I'm no longer running the show, and I don't need to run the show. And there's this peace and serenity when I can get there and do that, that I've never experienced before. And even that in itself is worth more almost than the blessings that I receive from that surrender that I'm willing to do. So I still have to practice on a daily basis. I don't do a great job of it, but when I do, it works. So I love, you know, I love saying when I work it, it works. And I've met so many wonderful people here, and I just want to thank you for this opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I know that God is here, and I know that He cares, and I know that there's nothing impossible with God. So thank you.
That back.
Hi, my name's Audrey. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 20th of 2001, and my home group is a Spirit of Recovery group in Lakewood, Colorado. That was fun. It just reminds me that it works really well. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time when I was 27, and I went to 2 meetings in one day because I kind of figured that a lot of the problems in my life were due to alcohol, and I just needed to stop. And so I went to those meetings, I bought a big book, and I went home to read how it works. And I couldn't understand a thing. So I put the book away for 3 years and stopped drinking. miraculously. For 3 years, I was dry, and eventually decided that it would be okay if I drank again. And it makes a lot of sense now. So I went to the Steamboat Brewery and had this idea, and it was like the switch had been flipped. I had a beer and felt kind of queasy afterwards and thought, that wasn't that bad. I think I'm probably okay to start buying six packs and keeping them at home because, you know, who doesn't like a beer after work? And that started the road again for me. And a year and a half later, I was drinking out of control. And so I thought, I should probably stop again. And so I tried. And I couldn't. I tried everything I could think of. And at the time, I was working for a major airline. I was a flight attendant. I was 32. And the job lent itself to lots of isolation drinking, which is what I loved to do, because people were just too much work. So I decided that I was going to stop drinking again, and I couldn't. And so I would be on the airplane, and the pilot would say, flight attendants, prepare for landing, and that little bing would go off in the cabin, and inside of me, something got turned on, and I thought, you know, I should probably just stop at the liquor store. No, you shouldn't. Well, yes, I could. Well, no, you shouldn't. You know you shouldn't. And this is what was going on in my mind. And the obsession of the mind had taken hold. And I could not fight it. I couldn't. And that proved to continue that way for a couple of years. Once I would go home with my six-pack, or, you know, if there was a 12-pack on sale, what a deal. And so I would buy the 12-pack, deluding myself that I was only going to drink a few, and would drink the entire 12-pack. And I was starting to concern myself. And so I decided that I was just going to stop. And I couldn't. And I would wake up in the morning, and I was dead serious that I was done. And by noon, it didn't seem like, you know, maybe I was just making too big of a deal out of nothing. And I would drink, and I never won that battle, ever. So my thinking around that was that I just probably had a lot of things going on inside that needed to be worked out. And as part of that idea, I went to get some energy work done. And the woman that did the energy work said, you know, maybe we should talk first. And I said, okay. Seemed reasonable. And for whatever reason, she was the very first person ever that I told my drinking to, how I drank, when I drank, when I didn't want to, how once I started I couldn't stop, and how I did not understand that. And it was killing me. And she said, well, you know, you could go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had been there those 3 years prior to that, and the thought never occurred to me. It was like I had not even been there. And I said, oh, I tried that. And I went to two meetings. It didn't work. And it seemed reasonable to me. And she said, you know, and I was complaining about certain things that I saw and heard, and I just wasn't ready at the time. And she told me about some women's meetings that were really, really close to my house, and so I started going. And I went to my first meeting at Edit, and I was about 7 days sober, I guess. It's kind of a blur. But I remember sitting out in my car before I went into Edit, the clubhouse where the meetings are held in Lakewood. And I thought, my life was over. This is what it had come to. And I sat in the car, and somehow God gave me the courage to walk through the front door. And there was someone at the coffee bar, and I said, is there a meeting here? And she said, yeah, it's downstairs. And so I went down, and it was so bizarre. People were sitting there, women, and the meeting started, and there were these things hanging on the wall that I did not know, understand a lot of the vocabulary, like inventory. And they started to read out of the book, out loud, to each other, and I thought that was so bizarre. And then they started to share their experience. And while I was sitting in that meeting, or the next meeting that I went to, the second meeting, I can't remember which one it was, the thought came that I have found the purpose of my life here on this earth. And I didn't understand it. I do today. I understand it very clearly today. And so that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, when people spoke about their drinking and they spoke about their recovery. They spoke in ways that I could only have dreamt of. I could not articulate what I was thinking, what I was feeling, and I didn't understand what was happening to me. 4 months later, I got a sponsor. And I remember before that 4 month period thinking that going to a meeting a day was enough. Going to listen to the same people in the same room the same day of the week was enough. And at about 4 months, and I would sit and people would talk about fear and they would talk about resentment in these meetings, and they probably talked about God, but I don't remember that. And when they would talk about the fears, I thought, why is everyone so scared? What is everyone so scared of? And then I started working the steps, and I got scared. Fast. around 4 months, I could feel that I was on my path to picking up a drink again. It's just a feeling. I knew it well, and it was coming. So I was like, well, what should I be doing differently? And then I remembered what you all had told me over and over and over again. Get a sponsor. And so I went to one of the women's meetings that I was attending regularly, where the same women showed up week after week. Thank you, God, for people that keep coming back. Even when the booze isn't on them, they keep coming back. So I went, and I found a sponsor, and she started taking me through the big book. One chapter at a time, one step at a time. And we did it like it was outlined. She explained to me what it meant to have the phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind. And she helped me understand that that was what it was like to be powerless. And I had evidence, stacks and stacks and stacks of evidence, to prove to myself I didn't need, I wasn't in denial around that. I just needed someone to help me understand it. And she did. And then we started down the steps even further, and we started talking about the bedevilments and unmanageability. And she said that the bedevilments were the identification piece of the unmanageability. Because I had a job, I had a relationship, I had a paycheck, I didn't get a DUI. My life was not unmanageable. I could barely get up in the morning, and I was really depressed, but that didn't count, because I could cover that up. You didn't have to see that. Everything else out here still looked okay. So she described to me that these were the things that described and explained the unmanageability. We moved through the steps to the third step, second step, third, through all 12. And I finally got to the place where I was then in a position where I could start sponsoring women. At about, and my life was and is amazing. At around 5 years of sobriety, I don't know what happened. Well, I didn't know what happened. I was sponsoring people. I had a sponsor. I had a service position. I had a home group. And I remember at my four-year birthday, I had a roommate at the time, and she was in the kitchen cooking breakfast. She was so happy and talking about whatever. I don't even remember. And I remember lying in my bed thinking, ugh, I wish I was her. My life felt like it was falling apart again, and I couldn't explain why. And it went on like that for about a year before I took some action. And what got me to the place to take the action of ask someone to take me through the work again was that I was becoming and slowly moving towards not being neutral around booze anymore. And I was cleaning up after a work party, and I picked up a half full or half empty, depending on how you want to look at it, beer. Looked full to me. And I remember going into this room and getting ready to dump it out, and it was like it came alive. And I remember driving out around that same time, driving out of the parking lot at the clubhouse and thinking, I wonder how long it's going to be before I don't want to ask for help anymore. And when I say ask for help, I meant when I wake up in the morning, I say, please protect me from alcohol. And when I go to sleep at night, I was taught to do these things. I didn't think these up myself. Thank you. And meet with a sponsor once a week. Go to meetings, that kind of a thing. When am I gonna get into a place where I am just not willing to do that anymore? And I was over at a friend's house and was talking to her about this, and I was telling her about this weird thing that happened after cleaning up after this party. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I have no idea. And it prompted me to ask someone to take me through the steps. Around this time, I had gone back to school. After September 11th, I took a leave of absence from the airline. Couldn't stand the job anymore, but had no way out, is what I felt like. And through the steps and the people in this program and asking God to help me, I was given the courage and the power to move forward and go back to school. And I was getting ready to graduate. And so I graduated from college. I got a bachelor's degree in biology. And for the next 3 years, I could not get a job. I did not have the power. And this correlates to that time in my sobriety where I was starting to feel like I was tanking. So I started through the steps again and was given help by a sponsor who was not attached to the outcome, told me the truth of what I needed to hear, and helped me through the steps and specifically through inventory. What were the beliefs that were blocking me off from being able to apply for jobs? It sounds, and it feels, even just saying it right now, how could that have even happened? I mean, I would open up my laptop, and I would look at it, and I would be frozen. And I needed to make some changes. I had a part-time, very part-time job. Wow, that went really fast. Time's up. So, life is great. Thank you.
Hi, Randy Alcoholic. I got sober December 9th, 2005. I have a sponsor named Ava, and her sponsor is Cookie, who I know some of you know. My home group is the Atlantic Group. We meet every night of the week in New York City. Our main meeting is Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. All are welcome, 60th and Park. And it's about a 600-people meeting, so it's pretty fabulous. So I'm not sure if I'm nervous or if this altitude is still just kicking me. It's for real. No joke. I was like, ooh, Mile High, you're Denver, you're Colorado, you're so cool, but it's for real. Anyway, so I'm a nice Jewish girl from Long Island, and I'm an alcoholic, which I didn't really think was possible, but it is. And I grew up in a home where my father, still today, is an active alcoholic and drug addict. And it was, you know, when you got sick, you got a Percocet. My father always had the best scotch, always had the best wine. Everybody would always drink at my house. And my father's motto was, as long as my children are drinking under my roof, all is fine. And that worked great for me. So at 12 years old, I decided that I wanted to have 4 cups at Passover of the Manischewitz Red Concord grape wine. And I had arrived. After that 4th cup, I literally felt like, this is how I want to feel all the time, and why don't I just feel like this naturally? And before I ever picked up that drink, I mean, you hear all around in the rooms, you know, I was restless, I was irritable, I was discontent. I mean, I was full of fear. And I share this a lot, you know, when I was younger, I couldn't go away to sleepaway camp because I was terrified. I couldn't, you know, be alone because I was terrified. I mean, fear ran wild. And, you know, I always called it, as I started getting older, I called it anxiety. I had an anxiety disorder. I was depressed. And I went to psychiatrists when I was younger, and I went to therapists. And, you know, as I got older and my alcoholism started progressing, you know, I had doctors say to me, I don't know what's wrong with you. And the truth of the matter is, for the alcoholic, like, we really, until we find Alcoholics Anonymous, this is my experience, I did not know what was wrong with me. I could not differentiate the true from the false. I was paranoid. I was delusional. I still today have amazing conspiracy theories. I'll give you examples of those in a little bit. And I have self-centered fantasies all the time. So a great example of this is last week an email comes in to my work email from the deputy director of my office, and the title of the email goes something like this. I'm a social worker, P.S. What social workers do when they're not at work. And the email proceeds to go into how Randy, me, on the subway platform, finds a homeless man that's passed out and goes over and helps him, waits there for 911 to come, for the ambulance to come, goes with him to the hospital. Now, none of this happened. That story did not happen. That email did not go out. Those are things that my head creates because I am selfish and self-centered to the core. All that I think about all the time is me. I get a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And the reason why, you know, for me as an alcoholic, I have all of the spiritual structures that I have in my life. I have a lot of sponsees. I do service in my home group. I do service below the group level. I have a sponsor. I have all of this stuff because I do not have the luxury to feed into that self-centeredness any longer. I am not okay with just being okay. You know, I've come to the point in my sobriety where I am interested in growth, and the only way that I do that is by working this program on a daily basis. Anyway, so, you know, our stories are all the same. I'm not getting into the gory details, but bottom line is everybody knew that I had a problem. And, you know, the truth is I knew that I didn't have the language for it, but I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. Like, I knew that I could not stop drinking, no matter how hard I tried. And it finally, I had a gift of desperation where I said, I can't do this anymore. I need help. And thankfully, I had parents that you know, had the means, and, you know, rehab is a part of my story, although you do not need to go to rehab to qualify for being an alcoholic, but I did go to rehab, and it was there that the seed was planted, not so much about AA, but about the disease of alcoholism. And from there, you know, I went back to the city, and it was a lot of things, you know, that were told to me in rehab were not necessarily told to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like, I couldn't go back to my apartment because that's where I drank. I had to stay away from people, places, and things. And that's not to say that, you know, at 2 days you should go into a bar, but, you know, it says in the big book, if I have a motive for being there and I'm spiritually fit, then I can go anywhere in the world. And I found this sponsor who, like it talks about in the book, you know, Bill sees Ebby, and there was something about his eyes. And I saw this woman at a meeting, and I literally chased her out of the room. And I called her the next day and asked her to be my sponsor. And I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I had this, again, gift of desperation, and I knew I needed help. And she immediately, based on the program that she had been through, began to put structure into my life. So I had to call her at 8:30 in the morning. I had to meet her once a week to read through the book. I had to go to certain meetings that she went to. I had to get a service commitment. I had to get a home group. And I was like, whoa, I don't think you know who I am. And she actually did know who I was. You know, I was a selfish, self-centered egomaniac. And all that I could think about was myself. And it was only through that gift of desperation that gave me the willingness to do the things that she asked me to do. And I'm grateful that, and I don't know why we're here and some people aren't. I personally don't believe that God is not helping those people and he helped us. I can't believe in a God like that. I, for some reason, had that gift of desperation, and I got it, and I'm grateful for that. So I started doing these things, and, you know, I don't really have dramatic, profound amends, which I hear a lot of people share, and I'm like, oh, I wish I had that. You know, I wish my mom was like, oh, thank God, you're so, you know. I mean, I harmed my family to pieces. I mean, I related a lot last night to what Kent was talking about. My mom waiting up at night and then me coming in like, huh, why are you up, you know? And just the obnoxiousness, the selfishness, the, you know, the entitlement, the grandiosity. My sponsor has this amazing 10-step inventory worksheet that we use in my family, and we have like a glossary of defects. And whenever I do a 10-step, a resentment or a fear, check, 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 check. I mean, I fit the bill for all of them. And I have some really amazing ones that stand out in pretty much every inventory, but my defects, and I'm sure all of ours, you know, there's a litany of them. Anyway, so the amends that I did were freeing, but truthfully, what mattered more to me about the amends is the change in my behavior. Because again, my mother didn't want to hear, I'm sorry. My father didn't want, I'm sorry. My family and friends who said, you know, we were so disappointed in you. I was embarrassed to be your friend. You know, things like that. They didn't want to hear, I'm sorry. They wanted to see me change. And so my spiritual experience, like it talks about in the book, and I'm just going to read it. Once in a while, alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So when my... Don't give me the two-minute, Pam. I'm just kidding. When my mom calls, I pick up the phone. When, you know, the phone bill comes in, I pay it, even though I paid it last month, and I don't understand why I have to pay it again. You know, I have direct... Did you actually give me the 2 minutes line? Okay. I have direct conversations with people. Just an example of a conspiracy theory. I know I'm all over the place, but maybe you guys can relate to this. You know, my boss, I've been working on this project, and my boss sends out this email putting two other coworkers in my office in charge of this project. And, you know, the theory that I come up with in my head is, she doesn't like me, I'm going to get fired. She's actually talking to these two coworkers about me, letting them know, I know Randy's been working on this project, but she's going to be out pretty soon, so I'm going to put you two kids in charge. Like, these are the thoughts that come into my head. These are the ideas that I have that need to be rearranged because I have a disease of perception. The way that I see reality is very different than the normal person. And this has been proven to me because I've asked the normal people in my life what they see about a situation, and it is drastically different than the way that my mind perceives it. And the reason why why alcohol worked for me is because it restored that to sanity. I became sane when I took a drink because I saw reality the way that the normal person sees it. When I'm not drunk, and I'm stone cold sober without a program. I'm selfish and self-centered. I'm dishonest. I cause harm because I don't see the world the way that other people see it. If you're not talking about me and this world is not revolving around me, then something is the matter. And that needs to be changed. And the only way that that changes is by a daily reprieve that I get contingent, right? Like it's based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And you know, Joe and Charlie talk about that 10, 11, and 12 are not the maintenance steps, actually, they're the growing steps. So when I get up to 10, that's really when the growth starts to happen. And that's really where 6 and 7 become integral in my life. I have to start looking at what are the assets that if God were to remove these defects of character, what are the assets that I would want God to replace them with? And then what can I do? What contrary actions can I take to bring those assets into my life? Because that's who I want to be today. I want to be a woman that's dignified, graceful, and has a lot more time to share. Thanks so much for having me.